Session number 6042, reel 10.
That the cigarettes henceforth had to be all taken out of the packets, and the Japanese then destroyed the packets, issuing merely the cigarettes. Of course, we had, before the confiscation of the newspapers, from reading them, and don't forget we are now in January and February 1945, we had sure knowledge from reading the Japanese newspapers, or what part of them we could read, Philip Christie and I, we knew that MacArthur was back in the Philippines. We knew that the war was getting closer to Japan. And because not only had we read it, but one or two civilian Japanese who didn't realise that they shouldn't say things to us about the war had told us that the Americans, which, because that's what they always said about their enemies in Japan, they only referred to the Americans were getting nearer to the homeland. Around this period, I lost one of my best friends in the camp. He was Private Sid Tyler of the Ordnance Corps, who had been with me in Thailand. He'd been one of my cowmen. You may recall I told you about driving cattle. He'd come with me. He'd come on the party because I was going on it. And he just had a little scratch on his foot in the zinc foundry. And because of his general lack of good health and his malnutrition and all the diseases he'd suffered in the past, the Dutch doctor, Lieutenant Brass, who attended him, he could not stop the blood poisoning, slowly moving up his leg. And I went to see him for 4 days, and on the fourth night, Dr. Brass said, "You won't see him alive again because the poisoning will reach his heart in the night." And poor Sid Tyler died in the night. A grossly inflated body due to the poisonous gases that had built up inside him and from oedema. His funeral was held the same day. The Japanese turned out in their ceremonial uniforms, and one felt quite sick at the thought that the simple treatment that would have allowed the Sid Tylers and the Watleys and the Pavlokuses and all the rest of them to have lived. I did not go to the crematorium with him. I couldn't face it. The Dutch padre, Captain Hamel, he went with 3 other men. And this little van-type hearse arrived. And Sid Tyler, who was a 6-footer anyway, but his body had become so bloated with this oedema that he'd had, this caused his death, that before he could be put into the van, the hearse, so-called, his body had to be broken so that he sat up throughout the journey to the crematorium, and it was quite a revolting sight and an awful way to see one of your greatest friends leave the camp and leave your sight. In 1976 and 1981, I made a particular point of going to his memorial stone in Japan and placing poppies, which I'd taken from England, on his memorial stone. It is said that his actual ashes rest below his memorial stone in there. And after the war, I was glad to go and see his wife and his young son and take a couple of letters that he'd carried all the time he was a prisoner and some photographs. 2 of them. And they, in fact, told me that they thought he'd been killed at the fall of Singapore, but well might he have done for the miseries he'd undergone as a prisoner. Around this time, I became ill, and I had first bronchitis, and then I got pneumonia with it, and I became very ill, and I was admitted to the so-called camp hospital. And I got to the point where I couldn't breathe. And because the Japanese camp commandant held the British in a little more respect than he held the other prisoners for some reason, when Dr. Brass said the only thing that could save me was an injection of adrenaline, of which the camp had none, Fukihara sent out to the local civil hospital for 1 shot of adrenaline. A strong shot, which Dr. Brass gave to me, And it did bring me round, but ever since then I've had asthma of one form and another, bronchitis and asthma, from this, but undoubtedly that one shot of adrenaline saved the day. For long we had complained about the lack of meat. To this point we had been in the camp for 8 months and we had no meat ration whatsoever. And of course in cold weather and the lack of other good food, our food there was about 3 times worse than it ever was in Thailand, not only in quality but in quantity. And one day the Japanese said, "We have a huge load of meat for you." And some horses and carts brought in a great load of whale meat. It turned out that a whale had been washed ashore a few miles north, and they had cut up the whale and they brought a lot to the prisoner of war camp. From the quantity they brought, it worked out to about 2 pounds of whale meat per man. Being a butcher by trade, I had a susceptible nose for bad meat, and I decided that this meat was bad, and I decided I would not eat it, however hungry I was, and I so advised others of my friends and all of the British and anyone else who cared to listen. However, so great was the hunger for meat that most of the camp ate huge quantities of this whale meat. And not only did they have the meat, but the blubber of it was rendered down into fat, into dripping, and the rice was cooked in it. Within 48 hours, 98% of the camp were diabolically sick. This created a crisis because the coal miners couldn't go to the coal mine, the zinc men couldn't go to the zinc foundry, and myself and about 30 others were the only people that hadn't touched the whale meat. And the most incredible things happened during this period, things that would never happen otherwise. A great friend of mine was lying on his mat, cold, because it was still frosty, hoping that he'd die because he felt so awful from these stomach pains. And a Japanese sentry came up to him and just pricked him in gently with the bayonet, telling him to get up and salute. And this man turned round to him and said, "You effing Nippon, you go and F yourself." And I was with the Japanese, and I said, "For God's sake, watch what you say." And he said, "Well, perhaps he'll kill me and put me out of my misery." So great was the torment. But the Japanese, I said to the Japanese, "He's very sick." And the Japanese grunted and walked off. He hadn't hurt the man at all, just touched him with the bayonet to try and waken him up. But there were some great problems at this period. But after 4 or 5 days, this terrible food poisoning, in fact that's what it was, had worked itself out, and people went back to work slowly. And the Japanese became nastier because they'd lost production, which they vitally needed by this time in the war. About 3 weeks after this, the Japanese said, "We have another issue of meat for you." And I was sent to the gate to collect it as it came in. And 3 or 4 little hand carts came in, each pulled by a woman. And on these hand carts were a total of 50 dead dogs, skinned right down to the tails. These were put into the stew pot. And the dead dog didn't taste too bad because, bear in mind, the Japanese were very, very short of meat in civilian life, so the dogs hadn't had the chance to eat much meat, so the meat wasn't very strong. Again at this stage, Baron Mitsui, the head of the gigantic Mitsui Empire, attempted to send food into the camp, because he was very pro-Western himself, in fact. And the Japanese army refused to allow it to come in, saying it was an insult to them to offer it because it was suggesting that the Japanese army couldn't feed its prisoners. Time rolled on. All sorts of traumas happened in the camp. Lieutenant Little turned in 2 American prisoners, CPO Fenari, Private Knights, and a third one, Corporal Johnson, for minor infractions of his rules in the mess hall. Corporal Johnson was beaten to death. Private Knight was beaten to death. Chief Petty Officer Fenari was heavily beaten, but was not beaten to death, and survived to give evidence against Lieutenant Little after the war, when he had become an officer and became Lieutenant Fenari. I had to intervene in the maltreatment of an Australian prisoner of war, Private Krasnerstein, who had made the terrible mistake of going down the coal mine with a cigarette, which, of course, is dangerous and all the rest of it. But he was mercilessly treated for 3 days. They put a ladder over his head, and Japanese soldiers took turns in doing seesaws on the ladder, which was resting on Krasnerstein's shoulders. But eventually, he was saved from much humiliation and pain by, again, the intervention of the Japanese I've mentioned earlier, Private Krasnerstein.
Private who?
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon. Private Higashino. Private Higashino. I mentioned him earlier, of the 48th Infantry Regiment, home in Hiroshima. I have his photograph, and I've never been able to trace him, so I presume he was killed in the war in some form, either in bombing or perhaps in Hiroshima itself, in the atom bomb. I should point out now that the guards in this camp were half army from the local infantry depot, who came in for 28 days at a time and then were relieved. And they brought the NCOs into camp. The other half of the guards were what the Japanese call gonzoku, and this particular lot were disabled servicemen from the past. There were a couple of ex-sailors who'd lost an arm during their combat activities. And don't forget, the Japanese had been at war with China since 1937, and they'd had fairly large casualties. There were men with missing bits of the body, and they walked around with a bayonet, some of them with a rifle and bayonet, some of them with a sabre. And they were just disabled soldiers who'd been put to good use guarding prisoners of war. Some of them were better than the average guard, and one or two of them were worse than the average guard. The worst one of all was, we call the sailor, because he'd been disabled as a sailor in the China War, war with China in the 30s. And he was armed with a bayonet, but he carried in his remaining arm a stick shaped like a Japanese samurai sword, and he used to like beating people with it. And other days he would carry a baseball bat, and he was very adept at beating people round the head with a baseball bat. I suppose the most interesting or most amusing things that happened to me personally in Camp 17, because there's always some humour to be found in any situation, or almost any situation. When we had arrived, we'd had to fill in a record card to which was attached the photographs they'd taken of us in prison uniform. And amongst the things you had to fill in on the card was your hobby. Now, what for, we can't imagine, and your civilian occupation. And I put down as my hobby playing table tennis, amongst other things. And when this little consignment of American Red Cross came in January, February, which they did not issue, the officers were asked to go to see the Japanese commandant to see if they would like to buy a table tennis table. Now, you might wonder what we could use for money. Well, the officers were paid, in theory, and once a month we signed for our pay. And the pay was the same rank, the same pay as the equivalent Japanese army rank got, but we were never actually given the pay. For instance, my own pay was 85 yen a month. 60 yen was immediately deducted for food, which, of course, was the usual muck that everyone else got. There was another deduction for the loan of a mosquito net, which we didn't have. There was another deduction for amenities, which we did not have. And it left a balance of about 10 yen. And every month this was put into Japanese war bonds. And when we were asked if we'd like a table tennis table, we said we'd got no money, they said, oh, you can cash some of your savings bonds. So we duly signed away some of our savings, which we'd never seen, of course. And the table tennis table with two bats and one ball and a net arrived. And when we opened it up out of this little box it was in, little crate it was in, it was stamped International YMCA for the American Red Cross for prisoners of war. So they'd sold us what they'd been given, and presumably our savings bonds had been cashed to line someone's pocket. The other purpose that they allowed us to cash savings bonds for was if someone had eyeglasses and broke them, either in the coal mine, zinc foundry or in the camp, the prisoner would be sent with a guard down to the town to an optician or to the hospital where he'd be measured for a new pair of glasses, and then the cost of them would be deducted from one of that nation's officers' savings in the Japanese post office. A rather crazy Kafka-like situation, really. A red letter day for the camp, as spring got a little stronger and it became a bit warmer, we had our second issue of meat. Again, these ladies arrived pulling these little handcarts, and they were 100 dogs. And that was the last meat issue in that camp. By this time, due to lack of food, protein and the various vitamins, many people had all sorts of illnesses. I suppose it would be boring to say them all, but there were all the things they had in Thailand, and plus a lot of others. And overriding all of it was stress. The stress of living in this confined area with the Japanese literally on top of you all the time. The tendency had been in Thailand, for when you'd come home from work, however much work it was, and once you'd done roll call, the Japanese tended to leave you to stew in your own juice. Here you are constantly under observation. The guards patrol the camp all night. They patrol the rooms. They checked on the fact that your little number tag showed where you were, because that, in fact, was one of the laws of the camp. But you had a little wooden tag and you had to put it to show where you were at any given moment. If you were in your bedroom, we'll call it that. If you had to show if you were in the toilet, you had to show if you were in the mess hall, you had to show if you were in the bath, you had to show if you were going to work, you had to show if you were going on parade. And the slightest deviation from following the rule merited a beating up. And I suppose it can be summed up in a multiplicity of diseases. I was lucky I did not get a recurrence of malaria there, and I did not get a recurrence of dysentery. That came later in Manchuria. But I had we all had this weakness of a lack of resistance to disease. And I had a period when I couldn't walk due to a most minor scratch on my leg turning into a deep-seated poisoning. And I could only walk around with assistance during this period. And the treatment for it was quite painful, of course, because there was a complete insufficiency of any medical treatment. The only drugs available in the camp were a thing the Japanese called a creosote tablet, which was supposed to be good for diarrhea and dysentery, and mercurochrome, that pink stuff that you paint on cuts, bruises, and abrasions. The camp had a superb operating theatre given by Baron Mitsui, most efficient and modern one, but unfortunately it lacked the medicines and the sufficient anaesthetics for a lot of surgical work. The bulk of the surgical work in the camp consisted of repairing minor injuries like broken legs, broken arms, and amputations. There were several men in the camp who'd lost both legs from injuries in the coal mine, either by coal trucks running over them or generally by coal trucks running over them. But there were a lot of operations for hernias. As we had been starved of fat for many, many months, in fact for 3 years, so the fat tissue that controls, that surrounds one's stomach, had been consumed by the body, and any heavy work tended to cause a hernia. And I got a double hernia there, but I couldn't be operated on until I'd been back in England for 3 years. But quite a lot of men who had them very severely to where they could have a strangulation hernia, they in fact were operated on by some very fine American and Australian and Dutch surgeons in the camp. And injuries to the face that occurred in the coal mine through roof falls, which did damage to the face, particularly around the jaw, were again operated on, sometimes without anaesthetic and with great pain, by an American doctor, American dentist, Major Schott, who was a superb dentist, but a corrupt, cunning member of the Democratic Mafia. I think his existence was marked by the fact that he was fit and fat. But as I say, it does not detract from the fact that he was a superb dental surgeon. And a lot of men who went there have him to thank for the fact that he wired up their faces and jaws to leave them not too damaged. Well, after the second 100 dogs, which I mentioned, as spring progressed, the Japanese allowed the sick to go onto the local beach to collect clams, and again on another occasion to go to a local swamp and catch frogs, and these supplemented the diet. The clams, of course, were full of sand, and they acted rather abrasively on the bowels, and if you ate some of this clam soup, you had a fair ration of beach sand, and what dysentery and diarrhea couldn't do to you, the sand did, but clams are very full of protein, so they were eaten. Again, the frogs, the cooks boiled the frogs and jointed them up. So you might touch to get a frog's leg or a frog's forehead or a frog's head or part of a frog. I've never been able to look a frog in the face ever since. The relationship between the various nationalities remained quite good, although the Geneva Convention, as you know, says that the capturing power should not mix up the prisoners in different nationalities, but the Japanese did it quite deliberately and willfully, and sometimes tried to foment dissent between them by criticising the English and hoping the Americans would support it, or criticising the Americans and hoping the British and Australians would support it. But they never succeeded because the prisoners remained cohesive and allied all the way through POW life, with minor little squabbles. And of course I am accepting these 20 or so Americans who corruptly ran the camp effectively for their purposes, I mean, not effectively for the good of the 2,000. An example of the Japanese attempt to split us was when they started this issue of Red Cross for good work, what I referred to as the Stakhovanites, a Russian expression. They even tried, in the first reward system, to issue these little perks only to American coal miners. And when they were tackled on this, they said, well, it was American Red Cross, and they were only going to give it to Americans. Well, you can imagine how this would have upset the British, Australians and Dutch. But the Japanese were persuaded that the American Red Cross issued it for all prisoners of war, and the boxes were so marked, which they were. It wasn't marked for American prisoners of war, it was marked for prisoners of war. That is just an example of how they carried on. The other amusing thing regarding myself was that this table tennis table, one day I got an order to report to a room in the camp where the table tennis table had been erected. And a Japanese warrant officer was there who said he was good at table tennis and he wanted to play me because he looked at my record card and found it was my hobby. He, in fact, was quite hopeless. And I had a job to let him win. And, in fact, I was so bloody-minded at the time, having recently recovered from some ailment or other, that I beat the daylights out of him. And within 10 minutes of finishing the game, a guard came for me and took me to dig some gardens, which I related directly, because I'd never had to do that before, I related directly to winning. But henceforth, without him noticing it, I played him left-handed. And I personally was very relieved when the only ball that had come with the table was broken and we couldn't play any more. A similar thing had happened with Philip Christie the previous summer on the Japanese tennis court. He'd been ordered to play tennis with some Japanese warrant officers and he'd beaten the daylights out of them and he'd spend days digging gardens ever afterwards till he learned his lesson, and the next time he played them, the Japanese always won. And that is called diplomacy. I've said we were moving into spring. We've gone out and collected frogs and we've gone out and collected snails and clams from the seashore. But the general health of the camp was deteriorating. Many men in the camp looked a little like walking skeletons. The pallor of the coal miners, either being inside in the huts resting, which they had to do to maintain some semblance of strength, and the rest of their day being spent deep underground under the sea, because I've said the coal mine was under the sea, the complexions were awful, and really it was all awful. One highlight of that camp, and an amusing highlight, is that one day the officers were called to a conference, and we were told that the camp was to be visited by the neutral powers. We were given our strict orders that under no circumstances would we speak to them. If they asked us questions, we would not reply. We would say nothing at all. Came the day, soon after dawn, a little truck arrived in the camp with a load of games, sweetmeats, and similar things, and a little room in the camp was set up as what I will call a tuck shop, and this stuff was put in the window. All the men that were in the camp hospital were removed from the camp hospital and put into huts, and the fittest men who should have gone to the coal mine were kept in camp, had a bath and were put into the camp hospital. From the local hospital came a supply of blankets and sheets and surgical instruments and nurses.